Welcome to the Operators Podcast, episode 48. I'm Roman, the president and founder of Peak 21. We buy and grow D2C companies. So if you have a company you want to sell, please hit me up. My DMs are open on Twitter and on LinkedIn.
Yes, it's peak21.io. And then I think it's Roman Ecom. I think you're following me on Twitter.
Roman Ecom.
Yeah, I love that. And thank you to Fulfill, Sendlane, Northbeam. I use all that software. Roman uses some of that software. But if you're on that software, he will pay more for your company. So if you're gonna sell to Roman, he's looking for people on ERPs, people who are sending emails, people who understand marketing. It's a great episode. Roman tells us about his life, what he's been doing, you know, his state of the union. He was just at ECF, e-commerce fuel, big fans of the pod, talked to over 100 brands. He gives you the rundown of what you need to be doing to survive in 2024. And he's just a smart guy. So Roman, thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We're officially over 1 million downloads per episode. Number one podcast on earth. Thank you so much, guys. Talk to you later. What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Operators Podcast. I want to talk about Fulfill, my ERP, and here's our journey with them, okay? We started just with warehouse management. We have 5 warehouses. So we have a customization warehouse. We have 3 nodes in the US, and we had Canada at the time. Maybe we had some international ones, but as you can see, I have way too many warehouses, and we had employees managing order flow. Wasn't a good system, right? It would break. People would ship the wrong thing. Keeping inventory in stock on the website was a mess. So I'm like, okay, we need a WMS. We started with Fulfill because it was lightweight, easy to implement, cost effective. You know me, I'm Mr. Cost Savings. So from there, we moved into a wholesale 3PL. So we added another node that just does B2B orders. And that required getting EDI set up into Fulfill, right? If you don't know what EDI is, it's like the worst technology ever. And I used to have to set them up individually with 3PLs, but by setting up with Fulfill, they can route the orders with EDI all these different places. So I don't have to go to a random 3PL from the 90s and get them to adopt Nordstrom's EDI integration or whatever. So that saves us a ton of time, a ton of money. Then we added accounting. Okay. So moving past QuickBooks. People tell me that if you're doing more than 50 million a year, you shouldn't be on QuickBooks, but we were doing over 100 million a year on QuickBooks. But at a certain point when you're manufacturing stuff and you're buying component parts, it's like, okay, we need to get on the big leagues. So we have the accounting module for Fulfill. So I'm fully set up on Fulfill. I'm probably the most complex Fulfill customer you've ever talked to. I'm like Voltron putting together all the different Fulfill pieces. We keep investing in Fulfill because the team's great. We get an ROI on the product, and they haven't tried to charge me $8 million a year or whatever NetSuite tries to charge you. So they do the implementation for us. They work with our team. It's been working. It's been set up. And now I got the infinity stones of all the different modules, and we're a fully functioning ERP, ran lightweight on the internet. Thank you, Fulfill, for doing that for us. Thank you for sponsoring the Operators Podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Let's keep going. What's up, everybody? Episode 48 of the Operators Podcast. We have another guest episode. So we have Roman, big dog extraordinaire, long friend of the pod, one of my go-tos for anything e-com related. He has a portfolio of brands doing over $100 million a year. I think he's touting 20 million plus in EBITDA, something like that. He'll tell us the real numbers and he'll tell us his secret sauce of what's working right now. He flew all the way from Hong Kong to do a remote podcast. So I don't know what that guy's thinking, but here he is, Roman, the man himself. What's going on, bud?
Thank you so much for having me. It's so good to hang with you guys live, finally, and I'm so excited to catch up. We're always, you know, one question for you guys. The description in the pod, I only noticed today actually, says that the group is hanging out in WhatsApp. But we're really on iMessage. What's the story behind
that? Oh, you're
that?
Not in the WhatsApp group, Roman?
I was like,
that's where all the good stuff is.
I was like, what? What's going on here? It's like the only group of American friends I have that actually use WhatsApp.
The reason why it says WhatsApp is just for the international crowd. Our producer is a non-US guy, and I think that was just the way he did it.
Smart. not a bad choice at all.
Yeah, you know, I think pretty soon I'll move over to WhatsApp just so we can or maybe we'll move over to Slack. I have a new Slack group going with the True Classic team. So maybe
or Telegram. Over. As yeah, it gets Telegram. More risque, it'll just go to a more and more deeply encoded, you know, encrypted.
Secret seclusive society. Awesome.
Okay. Well, Roman, what do you do? I gave you a brief summary, but let's hear what you do, and then let's talk maybe ECF and what does the landscape look like in 2024?
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, usually when I introduce myself, when I talk to founders, I feel like that's the most helpful thing to do, is to give a little bit snippet of my life story and what I do now, what led up to it. So I'm a fellow D2C founder, started my first D2C company. Let me take a step back, actually. I started my career in private equity, buying and selling companies. Then I got recruited by Rocket Internet. I don't know if you guys know Rocket Internet. Started by three German brothers. They were doing a PhD on studying, you know, US companies in Silicon Valley. They interviewed the eBay founders, realized 1 week after interviewing him that, you know, eBay should exist in Germany. So they flew back, quit their PhD program, cloned it, and I think they sold it back to eBay for $50 million 6 months in or something crazy like that. So they went on and cloned Groupon, and I was recruited to clone Amazon, actually. So I was the COO, CFO of Lazada, which was an Amazon clone, and we raised $700 million. It was obscene. I think at the peak, we were burning $1 million a day. Completely crazy. We were operating in six countries in Southeast Asia. The AOV was like $8. I saw a business go from 100 orders a day to 1 million orders a day. So I was completely addicted. It was insane, completely insane. So I decided to leave a year and a half before Alibaba acquired it, because Alibaba was roaming around the corners. It was really clear the writing was on the wall, and I wanted to get out before Alibaba took over. So I had $20,000 in savings with my wife, and we started our first brand called Linear. And the idea was to sell luxury handbags at a fraction of the price. We were completely moronic, trying to move a $400 AOV online. It's a classic story of like a first-time founder being obsessed with product and not distribution. So we crawled our way to millions of dollars of revenue in 2016. And by that time, it was big enough for both of us to quit our jobs. We're taking a turn working a job. And then by 2017, we made our first $1 million of EBITDA. So I used that $1 million of EBITDA and the street cred back then, because I was using my wife in the ads and we were doing $3 million on various Kickstarter campaigns. So a bunch of founders reached out and I was able to take a sweat equity position combined with cash, anywhere between 40 to 60% equity in three other DTC companies doing less than $1 million a year. I took over as the fractional CMO, and by 2019, we were doing $50 million as a group. And then we all know what happened in 2020, COVID happened, and we ballooned to $200 million in sales without having raised any external capital. So in 2021, we had a lot of investors knocking on our doors, especially in Hong Kong. So we had the Yam family. You can look him up on Twitter. His name is Jeffrey Yam, incredible guy. They own Forbes Media, the digital publication. So he came to my office. I kid you not, every single day we're in Hong Kong. And he was like, Roman, you need to take on capital to buy larger companies. I kept fending him off. 14 days in, I caved in. I took a bunch of money from him and a bunch of other investors in a blank check holdco. And now we go out and we buy D2C companies. We look for companies that are doing anywhere between $1.5 million of EBITDA to $5 million of EBITDA. And my ambitions now for the next 3 to 4 years is to buy another 10 great DTC brands. And overall, I want to do $100 million of EBITDA in 5 years from now. Current run rate is probably a little bit north of 30. I think we can add another 10 million this year if things go well. And yeah, that's me in a nutshell. So if you have a company to sell, please do reach out and DM me. My DMs are open.
Go ahead and email just Sean at operators and then I'll take that cut.
Yeah, we have a 100K cut. Yeah, if you send an intro. So yeah, I'll give each operator a 100K cut basically. That's an expensive deal, but let's see. Awesome.
So who's got the first question for Roman?
Okay, so I wanna ask about Rocket. So if you're listening to this, Rocket is one of the crazier OG e-com stories. first of all, your story is awesome, Roman. Like, just even hearing, I knew the pieces of it, but even hearing you tell it, how awesome. Like, man, congrats on the success, and what a story, what a like arc. And you're, I mean, it's not like it's over. You're just getting started, it sounds like, but it's awesome to see like all the things that the show's about grittiness and being, you know, making something out of nothing. I love the fact that you bootstrapped something to the scale that you got to. And then when you did take capital, you took it from a position of strength. But tell us about Rocket. You talked about scaling from like 10 orders a day to a million orders a day.
A million. So we, it was really interesting because in Southeast Asia, you don't have Black Friday, Cyber Monday, but you have Singles Day, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, 11/11. But you have to think about it. We literally invented e-commerce in Southeast Asia. There was no player in Southeast Asia. So when people were saying Lazada, it was the same way as people say Googling today. Like, people associated Lazada with shopping online. That was literally the association with our brand name. So we went from a warehouse of year one of like maybe, you know, don't quote me on this, but less than 10,000 square feet to a warehouse the size of 5 football fields in just Thailand with robotics. It was just completely obscene and insane. And I don't think anyone has seen this kind of blitz scaling before, that, you know, the term that the Somewhere Brothers coined. And it was just completely unprecedented. It was just like a privilege to have worked there. You also see everything that can go wrong and how this could only be born out of like a zero interest environment. It's just completely crazy. I think there are a couple of nuggets you can take from Rocket that I really learned. One was, you know, Ollie would call you randomly on a Monday. Okay. He would group
and
up.
Who's Ollie? For everybody who's listening to this that doesn't know. Yeah.
So Ollie, the founder, you should Google and read about him. And we would do management calls. So the first venture I worked on was actually cloning Zappos. We call it Zalora. And they have a clone in Europe called Zalando, which is a behemoth. And he would call you every Monday morning. We would have a call and he would ask random numbers like, okay, what is your contribution margin for Monday? And you wouldn't know the numbers. And he would just breathe the insecure overachiever in you and be like, why don't you know this number? You need to know your numbers. You need to be like a baker. In the morning, you count how many buns you have in the oven. At the end of the day, you need to know how many buns you sold. And he would just berate you. So number one thing you learn from Rocket Internet is he would hire MBAs, management consultants, former bankers like myself, because he knew how big of an insecure overachiever you would be if you came from these environments. And that was the fuel. That was the fuel. That was a rocket fuel. So I have a hiring framework right now where I will never, if there's a quadrant, right, there's a secure overachiever, that's a founder. That's you guys. I could never hire, retain, or employ you guys. I'm in the job of hiring insecure overachievers, and I'm completely shameless about it, right? And then you want to move them to being secure overachievers and make them CEOs or CMOs or COOs of the companies you buy, but you want them to start there. And that was a rocket fuel for Rocket Internet, pun intended. And that is like the number one lesson.
Roman, how does this work then? So you're a holdco of brands, you buy them.
Yeah.
With what you just said around the insecure overachiever, I could see Panzer just laughing his ass off at this. How do you deal with the founder then? So you mentioned you move them into another role. Like, I mean, I've got so many questions on how you do the whole thing, but like, how do you make this work when so many others fail?
Yeah. You have to think about it, right? Like, so when Jen, my wife, and I started with Linear and we got to $1 million, so EBITDA, we didn't have a real balance sheet. We had $1 million that we could take out, roughly, give and take, in 2018. So it was a lot of sweat equity. So the first three companies that we acquired was a lot of sweat equity and performance-based. And we were not in a position to really hand out cash. Now we are. So now we're looking to buy anywhere between 51% all the way up to 100%. In the 100% scenario, it's really straightforward, right? Like, the founder leaves, you have a 3 to 6 months transition period, and you onboard your own CEO or your own management team. In the case of the founders staying on, we're really looking for cultural fits. Like, I think you can't do business with a bad person. So we're really filtering for people who are great that we could imagine actually having a beer with after the workday and like hang out with. And that's filter number one. So we pride ourselves in not working with assholes. That doesn't make them less of an overachiever, though. Usually the people who stay on want to swing big and they're selling a piece to us because they have a big life event. Like, I just had a founder in here in the office now, just 30 minutes ago. He's like in his late 20s. He's going to get married. He wants a kid and he wants to take some chips off his table. But he's also looking for an investor who actually knows D2C and is aligned with where he wants to take the business and not like some random private equity.
Do you keep the founders around then? So when you buy the company, your ideal is you keep them around?
Ideally, yes. That would be our preferred option.
And what happens if you don't? So how do you manage all these brands right now?
What we do is we hire fresh graduates predominantly. So if you look at the holdco level, like if you count all the employees on an opco level and you exclude the virtual assistants, you're close to anywhere between 250 to 300 people, ballparking it. What we do every year is that we recruit 20 to 30 fresh graduates or people with maximum 2 years of experience, maximum. So there are consultants, investment bankers, you know, they come from a numerical rigorous background, and then we onboard them. What we tell them is two things, what I tell them when I hire them. One, I want to make you a millionaire. I want you to come in here and get rich when you leave. Two is that I will buy you a company one day. So if you stay with me for the next 3 to 5 years, I'm going to train you in PPC and paid marketing, how to run a DTC business. You can shadow me. And then eventually I'm going to buy you a company that you can own and operate. So that's how we do it. So we're looking for companies to buy now. We already have a bench of, you know, these fresh graduates that's been with us for quite some time, and they're hungry to sink their teeth into something. The problem for us now, right now, is finding great companies to buy, to be honest. And that's the biggest bottleneck.
Roman, why is that a problem, Roman? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, you think about it, right? Like I was at E-commerce Fuel. We should actually do a State of the Union because I think that's like a really good, I got a really good sense of the market. So everyone knows E-commerce Fuel, right? Like, so E-commerce Fuel is this incredible community that Andrew built. Andrew is this amazing guy on Twitter. I can't remember his handle, but yeah, Andrew is an amazing guy. And E-commerce Fuel is predominantly for bootstrap founders. The average member does, I think, 7 to 8 million US in revenue per year. Their businesses are older than 5 years. So you're really getting a strong idea of the Shopify ecosystem when you attend these things, because these are these merchants that actually survive. They might not be thriving like we are, where they're like exploding. Some of them are, but they're representing the Shopify ecosystem. Imagine now that you're running a $10 million business and you're generating $1 to $2 million of EBITDA. You're just in that threshold where we want to come in and buy you. You're making a comfortable living. You're making $500K, $600K a year. You're the king of your castle. So the idea of giving that up emotionally and financially is a big leap, because the truth is that we can't pay the most. We're not like P&G or Unilever. We have to make money at the second bite or cash flow things out. So I think we're in interesting times, because I think a lot of the founders are waiting for the economy, the market to come back, D2C, M&A market to come back before they entertain these conversations, to be honest. That's what we're seeing. But we're having great conversations. I mean, I was just recapping it with my M&A team earlier today. We probably have north of $25 million of EBITDA under negotiation now, like past the LOI stage. And, you know, anyone would know, like Jason could speak to it for volumes, that like deals fall apart, you know, at the last minute. And then we probably have another $30 million of EBITDA where we're in early stages of conversations. How much of that will convert at the end at the right multiple that makes sense for us? Big question mark. But I do think it's quite opportunistic to buy now, because there were 250 attendees at E-commerce Fuel, and 120 to 130 of them, I would say, are bleeding. They're struggling. Like, it's hard out there. Like, they're dependent on Meta. They're dependent on Google. It's tough. It's rough out there. Working capital issues, you name it. 50, I would say, are booming and thriving. Like, they're doing amazing things and taking off. And the rest, I would say, is a mixed bag.
How do you choose the winners out of the 99% garbage that's out there?
You know, you can, I think it comes down to, you know, you look at like how we hockey stick growth, right? Like, I think founders have a tendency to understate the factor of luck. You think about Raycom when I joined, you know, Ray Lee, this incredible founder, he actually DM'd me through e-commerce fuel. They were selling like 25 random products. When I came in, I said like, we're doubling down on wireless earbuds because that's when it's hockey sticking. So to answer your question, Jason, I think like the 80-20 is making sure you catch the trend early enough, that you're early in the door on the trend and the brand is there and they have a first mover advantage, I would say. And they have an established brand that can truly scale on the back of CAC to LTV. So that's the first filter.
Well, it sounds like it's just a big numbers game, right? You need to see enough deals.
Correct.
To find the needle in the haystack. And
100%.
You know, the luck component, of course, we talk about that all the time. It's like,
yeah,
it's at least 50% luck, maybe 80% luck to get 100%. To where brands like we are.
Exactly. And, you know, it is a numbers game. I feel like excuse my English, but I feel like a prostitute. I've talked to close to 100 founders in the last 5 days. When I got to, like, so you'll meet like my CEO, Edo, my head of finance, Dux. They literally took the attendee list on e-commerce fuel, which is like where I was speaking. There were 250 attendees. They analyzed everything like any M&A team would do. Like they took out the similar web traffic, all these like, you know, particle data or Shine Commerce data, all this data. And they were like, okay, these 14 people are the people you want to talk to, Roman. So they had like pictures of every single founder in this dossier document, like in Google Doc. So I had like a picture of Sean and like, okay, this is the company I want to approach. So I was like this like really like sleazy guy walking around the conference with like really strong cologne coming on to people being like, Sean, I really want to buy your business. I know you're selling XYZ. I want you. And I did this with like 14 founders. Like there were two couples. So I guess it was like 18. And two of these founders were like really turned off by my approach. And I refined my approach throughout the whole conference. But I'm happy and proud to announce that I have at least 6 or 7 good conversations.
So you're just split testing. You're just going to conferences and you're just split testing like crazy.
Yeah, like crazy. And I started my career in sales, you know, like my first job when I was in high school was like telesales. So it's not new to me, but like being out there in the field, trying to pump the numbers, as Jason said, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of legwork. You know, you need to get high numbers. I need to broaden my funnel for sure.
Wolf in the hen house, dude. Like Andrew's not going to let you back next year. You're just running around.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm pretty sure I'm banned for life.
If you're spending more than $1 million a year on paid ads, you probably have some amount of wasted spend. We all do. Marketing is the biggest line item on Ridge's P&L. So we spend more on marketing than we do on SaaS, people, or COGS. And 1% wasted spend can totally make or break a brand, right? And how do you determine if it's a channel messing up or if it's an ad messing up or if it's your team messing up? You need an independent source of truth there. So we recommend Northbeam multi-touch attribution. So what does that actually do? Facebook in platform wants you to spend more money on Facebook, right? They want to tell you that all of your sales are coming from Facebook. Google wants to say all of the sales are coming from Google, right? And you probably use Google Analytics, which is a last click attribution platform designed to make Google look better, right? So someone Googles your brand off of a Facebook ad, clicks a branded search term, who gets that sale? GA is going to say it's Google. Google conversion pixel is going to say it's Google. Facebook's going to say it's Facebook. How do you make sense out of that in this world? That's where Northbeam MTA comes in. A multi-touch attribution tool takes all of that data, all of their historical data, the billions in ad dollars that they've seen run through their pixel and their ad platform, and they determine the actual breakdown and who deserves the credit. So they got a team of data scientists from Stanford, Harvard, they got PhDs. And they've been working on this model for 6+ years. Pre-COVID, they were early movers in this space, and they know marketing attribution better than anybody else. Data is super flexible. They have more reports and metrics than any other platform out there. Over 450 you can choose from. I look at five and I use it to determine if I'm wasting money on different ad platforms. Do you think it's time to get on TikTok? Well, the best way to know that is to be able to compare TikTok versus a Facebook versus anything else. That's what Northbeam can do. And don't just take my word for it. Everyone on the podcast uses it. I've been on Northbeam. I was the very first customer 6+ years ago. Jason uses it. Dr. Squatch uses it. BlendJet, Reef Sandals, all 9-figure brands who love and use Northbeam every single day. So what are you waiting for? Get a demo. Go to northbeam.io. Click the link in the description. Tell them the operator sent you, and we're here to help. So thank you so much, guys. Thank you for the support. If you're ready to check out and get to the next level of ad spend, check out Northbeam. Thank you.
Roman, what are you doing? So like, on the front end, you're talking, your answer to Jason's question is like, you want to make sure that you're getting the trend at the right time. Are you trying to buy and hold these companies and operate them a long time? Or are you looking at like the trend is going to be this long and I want to be out of these businesses? Like, are you more of a buy private equity, like buy, hold for a bit, flip? Or are you a long-term hold on the space?
Yeah. So we want to buy and hold in perpetuity if we can. I mean, I can't mention the brand on name, but you know, we talked about it in our text group, right? Like we bought this brand in 2021. We sold it last year. And that was an amazing deal, right? Like we bought something that was doing 20 million. We were able to more than double it and then flip it. That was very opportunistic because a lot of people were interested in the business. But our premise and our thesis is to buy and hold great brands. If I look at like Raycon, if I look at Nutrition Kitchen, like two of our brands, like I have no issues holding them because they cash flow and they're profitable, right? If the right offer came around the corner and someone wanted to buy it, fantastic. But you know, I think we're going in with the mindset of just building beautiful businesses that cash flow.
What's your check size and structure? Like
yeah,
range.
Great question. So what we're looking at, like, so there, I would say we have three buckets of companies we're seeing right now. And we're very flexible because we have a big balance sheet ourselves. So there are high growth companies where the founder does not want to sell majority. We're open to that and can buy as little as 25%. So then it's more of like a growth round where predominantly in these cases, we're discussing secondaries. So the valuations are lower because it's not primary and it's going into the founder's pocket. The second bucket are like these stable cash flowing businesses. They're growing less than 30% a year, spitting out EBITDA. There we're able to pay anywhere between 4 to 6 times earnings. That's the range we're talking about. I'm talking like cash up front in closing. And then there's an earnout component. We'll buy anywhere between 51% to 100%. So obviously we can't pay the most, but we're fast, we're fair, and we're transparent. And then the third bucket is distressed. And we're seeing a lot of distressed stuff right now, like a lot, where they're just trading at, you know, inventory value almost. And we're talking really large companies.
I think that ties closely into the state of the union. So you gave a brief update that it seems like 50% of brands you talk to are struggling, 20% are totally crushing it, and then there's like a middle zone who are just kind of bumbling along. Do you want to go deeper into any of those? What are some macro trends? What are the challenges you're hearing from brands right now?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I would love to actually pull out the data and do a survey with these founders, because I feel like there's such a big selection issue when you read Shopify's quarterly report, because it's like everyone. And like here you're talking about brands that have been around for 5 years. So they're not new on the block, right? Like they've been around, they have a CRM, they have everything. If I were to say punchline headline level is anyone who's below $15 million of revenue a year, with like, let's say a below sub $150 basket size item, are struggling because of Meta. I don't know what it is, but being below 15 million and not having explosive growth to feed the loop, I don't know what it is not enabling them to unlock growth or get less volatility in Meta. That was a recurrent topic when I was talking to founders at Econ Fuel. So it seems like Meta is really not working. And we have a big sample size of this because we talk to 100+ founders every single month. And we see this recurrently. Like if you're sub $15, $20 million a year and you're Meta dependent, a lot of them are entering choppy waters. I'd be very curious to see the March numbers because I haven't looked at it. The beauty with what I do is I have access to 200 accounts, right? Like I have access to so many Meta accounts because when I'm doing diligence, I get access to all of them. And you're just seeing so much volatility. And I think the volatility doesn't necessarily impede the business. It impedes the decision-making. So you see these founders making the wrong inventory procurement decisions. You're making them do the wrong hiring decisions, right? Like it's just leading to a lot of really bad decision-making. And it becomes a very vicious cycle. So that's what we're seeing in the marketplace right now. And I think high level, that's what's happening to these bottom 50% brands.
So Roman, you mentioned that you're seeing people make the wrong decision based on the volatility. I guess here's my question. Is it the wrong definition or the wrong decision in retrospect, like kind of Monday morning quarterbacking? Or from your point of view, even in light of volatility, is there a better way to make decisions that these companies and founders aren't applying?
That's a really, really good question. To be honest, I haven't thought about it. And I feel like I'm not going to do it justice because I never go far enough deep into detail to understand, okay, why did you go from 60 days of inventory to a year of inventory? What happened here? You know? And I never peeled the onion enough to really understand what led to this decision. But it is very clear that the people who are crushing it right now have very strong comprehension of their own numbers and manage their supply chain very, very tightly. And they learned a shit ton in 2021. Like they got scarred, they came out of it learning a lot, and they're managing it really tightly. Those are the winners. But I wouldn't be able to answer your question, to be honest, Mike, but it's a good one.
I just want to double click what you just said, because I think it's really key. If you asked an entrepreneur like, hey, what does it take to be great at e-commerce? I just don't think many people would say supply chain in the first three or four things. But I think your point is such a good one. We've talked about it because it's one of the few things that can totally blow you out of the game. Just in a decision, you can end yourself. And it's worth really emphasizing that point with everybody listening to the pod. And to some extent, maybe this is why D2C is such a hard class to invest in and VCs don't want really to do it anymore because it is so meta dependent and meta does have volatility. I mean, like you said, you're seeing these numbers now. I mean, just the chatter I see on Twitter, it feels like it's post-apocalyptic on Meta right now in terms of people's performance. And so I would guess that a lot of poor decisions have probably been made in the last 30 days.
100%.
So maybe just what are one or two principles that you've learned on the supply chain side, mistakes you've seen people make, or things that you've learned from managing so many different companies?
Yeah. I actually wrote a thread about buying $30 million worth of goods in China every year. And it kind of went like it popped a little bit and it went a little bit viral, where I talk about the 9 most common mistakes. And I think the number one mistake I see founders make is I treat my suppliers like a bank. I look at them and I'm like, you're going to fund my business. That's how I enter the relationship. And that's how I think about them from day one. So we take a BOM-led negotiation approach. BOM stands for bill of material. A high level bill of material gives you a breakdown of the cost of making one of your SKUs by component. And it also discloses the factory's margin. This entails having a transparent, completely transparent relationship with your factory. And if your factory does not want to give you a BOM, they might not be the right partner. Once you have a BOM, you have to really understand that in China, interest rates are going down. Guess what the interest rate is for export financing for a watch factory in China? Just guess, like what it is per year.
2%.
2.2%. 2.2%. That's what they pay. That's what they pay the government for a fully insured invoice. They pay 2.2%. So that means you're placing $100 of orders this year. They're paying $2.2 to insure themselves from you defaulting. I think it's 80 cents on the dollar. Don't quote me on this, but it's in that ballpark. And they're getting financing to finance you so that you can grow. So if you have transparency with a BOM-led approach with your supplier, and you should just read my thread, I break down how to have this conversation with your supplier, you can actually get your factory to finance you. Because the way, what I tell founders now is like, you're one PO away from going bankrupt. That PO in Q4, when you're building up for Q4 inventory, if you get that wrong the year you're hockey sticking, the year Raycon went from 7 to 32 million and 32 million to 70 million plus, if you get Q4 wrong, you're dead. You're like dead. You know, you're just like, you have a truck running over you. So if you can take a BOM-led approach with your factories, you can turn them into a bank and, you know, manage your downside. And I think this is like,
man, such a good point.
Yeah.
Like for us in our business, I would guess that we have the equivalent. Oh, I don't know. I'm trying to do some back of the envelope math. You know, maybe we have $20 or $30 million in inventory at any given point in time. And we could easily have 3 months of that being floated by China. And so like,
easy.
It's at least probably $7 million of off balance sheet financing that we're getting.
That's it.
As a result of the partnership of the factory. And you're exactly right that it's such a symbiotic relationship that, you know, they're incentivized by to lean in and to help you to grow. So we had this whole conversation internally of, okay, should we diversify among several factories? Because there were a lot of factories that made what we, you know, what we sell, or should we concentrate? And what we really came up to was there were risks either way. That diversification, you have risks. Nobody's particularly loyal to you. You don't have deep, very deep relationships. There's not as much trust, you know, yada, yada. But also concentration, you've got all this risk, right? That if one factory blows itself up, whatever. And where we ended up landing is that the downsides of concentration risk were less than the downsides of diversification. You might not get the absolute sharpest to the penny pricing on any particular unit, but over a series of years, the things you unlock through that trust and that relationship end up being, you know, dwarfing it by comparison.
Yeah. I think you get what I call, like, you know, in Chinese, you say guangxi, like, right, like relationship. You just get, you get emotional leverage. I talk about this a lot when you're dealing with your stakeholders. So you have your customers, you have your employees, you have your factories, which are crucial. And then you have your financing partners, yada, yada, yada. And with your factories, if you take a concentrated approach when you're hockey sticking, this is very applicable to founder going from seven figures to eight figures, especially if you're growing really quickly. Concentration is your friend. Diversification is not your friend. Because you're carrying so much risk in general that I think like leaning in majority of the cases to one supplier is what's going to unlock a ton of growth. And that's definitely been the case for us, for all our businesses, actually. It's a common pattern we have for everything. We just don't diversify, frankly.
Roman, you've unlocked the clip of the episode. One of the secrets of Ridge's success, you know, we'll do over $200 million this year with never raising any money at all. There is no debt on our business at all. And it's because all of our financing comes through our factory relationships. And I will pay 10% higher COGS for 180-day lead times, right?
100%. Oh, for sure.
100%. Any day. Where do I sign? Yeah. Where do I sign?
and you know, I was just talking to a friend who has an apparel company, and his current line of credit is 18%. Right. And so he has $9 million employed at 17, 18, 19%, something like that. And I'm like, yeah, dude, it's cheaper just to have more expensive COGS and you have the factory in China just float you the whole time. And that's why today I have $15 million of inventory in my hands right now that I don't have to pay for 6 months. So,
wow.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it in the chat, but a lot of us are running negative cash conversion cycles with our factory. And we've got a similar deal with our mass retail orders where I think we have a lot of mass retail orders where we don't pay until something like 60 or 90 days after we invoice. So, you know, and some of these are like they're direct import programs where they'll, you know, China loads it on a ship and we still are going to get paid, you know, whatever, 120 days after they load it. So we invoice at the point that it's loaded. And there's this amazing amount of float. And obviously, when you get to like significant EBITDA and your financial fortress is kind of built, this stuff matters less. But in the early days, it matters a tremendous amount. And so it's counterintuitive, but you can actually tell an operator who doesn't necessarily know the best way to run their business when they're talking a lot about negotiating with several different factories or really driving hard for the last penny. Kind of to your point, Roman, there's so many different facets that you can negotiate across. And so there a lot of times it's like, yeah, we'll give you the concession on per unit cost, but we want all these other things over here, and they're happy to do it. And so part of being a good negotiator, like people think being a good negotiator is like, you want $3 for that, and I want to pay you $2.50, and I'm going to convince you we're going to be closer to $2.50 than we are to $3. And that means I'm a good negotiator. But a good negotiator is actually like, okay, you want $3 on that. Well, I want these other four things. And if I can get you to be willing to give me those other four things, I'm happy to give you $3. And there's the guy who did, Dan Rose, who did partnerships for Facebook. And then he basically was the guy who led up the Kindle team at Amazon. So incredibly accomplished guy. He has one of the best quotes about negotiation that I've ever heard, where he said most negotiation, people approach it like, okay, we've got a banana and we're trying to decide where to cut the banana so that, you know, whose half is a little bit bigger. And he said the best negotiations are actually where you've got a banana and through negotiating, you realize one person wants the fruit and the other one wants the peel. And both sides get more than they thought.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really well said. I think it's like what I see, the number one founder mistake I see people make is that they go in with like bare knuckles and they're just like, what is the MOQ? What is the price? You know, and they start the conversation in that manner. And when you walk trade fairs, which I do for a living because I live in Hong Kong, right? Like it's one of the biggest advantages I have by living there. Is you just see that attitude, and 9 out of 10 times, if you go in with that attitude, you're going to be stuck at seven figures, frankly speaking, because you're just not going to be able to grow, right? I heard something like, I heard from some guys that like, you know, True Classic runs their live data to their suppliers, and we do that with Raycon too. We're sending them like, mm-hmm. you know, updates every 3 days on like what's selling and what's not selling. And I think if you run with a very transparent relationship and you talk about the ups and downs with your suppliers, you're just going to win like big time.
It's are you transactional or are you a partner?
Yeah, exactly.
And people exactly. will throw that partner word around and so cheaply. And it's like, but true partnership actually means something. It means that when things aren't good, that we are willing to make sacrifices to help you get through and vice versa. And there is a level of trust that you build. And for us, it's like the reason why we win so big in our manufacturing relationship, the people on our account have been there for 7-8 years. They've been in my house. We've had countless meals together. We've talked about life together. There's a level of friendship and trust and intimacy that exists. And so, yes, for sure, we're going to get better work. We're going to get better benefits than some random person off the street. And we've earned that. We've put it in the relational equity and the but I think the main point here that I would emphasize is my experience is that Americans can be super transactional, especially with overseas and Chinese manufacturers, and that they really want to be relational. I think in many ways, they're more relational than we are culturally. And that when you lean into that, that's exactly what they want. And so a lot of times American brands will complain about, you know, their orders getting deprioritized or, you know, the factory chasing the highest dollar. If they do it and when they do it, it's almost always because they feel like they have to, because they feel like you could slit their throat over a quarter cost increase at any moment. What they really want is more of a monogamous relationships where they have 2 or 3 or 4 partners that are really with them and they can really depend on. It's been the transactional nature of the people that work with them that forces them to have other options and to keep other things on the line.
Yeah, for sure. I couldn't agree more. That's really, really the case. It's pretty crazy.
Roman. Question on like the way that you, I mean, this is great. Why could you maybe help people who are listening to this, like understand why is it that your like multi-brand model works. So like the thing that always breaks my brain with you, dude, is most companies do better if they focus on one thing as opposed to having multiple things, right? And most holding companies in public markets, we've talked about this in the pod, they actually traded a discount to their pure play components, right? So why is a brand better off inside of your structure, like your holdco, than on its own?
I think we don't have any synergies. We think synergies are really overrated. So the only thing we really centralize is paid marketing, influencer media buying, and supply chain. Those are the three things we really centralize. If you look at like the next like 12 months, I think we'll spend anywhere between 75 million to 100 million on buying media, which is an enormous amount. So obviously there's some synergy there on cost savings, but more importantly, it's the people. The fact that we can be calm in March because all our ad accounts are shitting themselves. We're not reading it on Twitter, but we're seeing all of our Meta ad accounts doing really poorly. I think that's the biggest synergy, being able to see pattern recognition there. But to answer your question, why companies would do better under our umbrella is because we will only do DTC. I will only do e-com until I die. I've been doing it for 11 years. I have no plans of changing my career. Next 40 years, I'm going to be doing this. We're going to be back here 40 years from now, like as grandparents, like in wheelchairs, probably hooked up to AI, talking Jason about Moore. Meta ads, right? Like we're still going to be here talking the same shit. Maybe our stuff is not made in China. Maybe we have 3D printers in the background. Who the fuck knows? But I'm going to still be doing this 40 years from now. So I think the synergy is just from focus and commitment and the marriage of just saying, I'm going to stick to this sadistic industry and continue going. That's why we're going to do better, because we just take a longer perspective on things. When I talk to founders, they're just like, okay, I'm going to squeeze my EBITDA this year because I want to run the process next year. I just don't have this inflated fake pressure put on myself, right? Like I think that's the hack, frankly speaking. It's just taking a long-term view. That's basically it, actually.
I'll be really honest with you. The cost savings is probably the biggest driver for me. I think I'm going to save like over $100,000 a year switching. And there is nothing I would not do to save $100,000 on SaaS. Like the whatever the darkest thing you're thinking, yeah, that's me trying to save money on SaaS. So that's a big driver. And look, I believe in the product. I've seen it. I've seen the demos. People are like, is the migration going to be a pain in the ass? Yes. That is why I did not migrate in Q4. It's never going to be painless to do one of these things, right? Like I've been on Klaviyo for 10 years. It's going to take some time and effort to put it in, but Jimmy is the type of guy who's committed to make it as seamless as possible. So I'm very, very excited to switch to SendLane. They're a startup, man. I think their culture matches mine. I'm excited to be there. So Photoshop a SendLane logo on my jersey, because that's where I'm going, guys.
Love it.
I want to ask Sean. I didn't know until I read it on Twitter, but you invested in Kenpai Foods. We both did. We backed Isaac. Amazing. Our Mr. Beast, the DTC Mr. Beast. Tell me why you invested in Kenpai. Maybe you want to tell what Kenpai Foods is and why you invested. I'm a big fan of Isaac. So
Yeah. So if anyone doesn't know Isaac, here's his Twitter profile. It'll be right here. Finn's going to edit it in. He ran Mini Katana, very famously a top 1,000 YouTube channel based around his sword e-com business. And I've known Isaac for 2 years, 3 years. I knew him before he had a Twitter account, before he was posting all his tips and tricks. And him and I used to fight on the internet on e-com fuel over TikTok. He was like, dude, TikTok's the future. TikTok's amazing. And I'm like, no way, dude, YouTube is way better than TikTok. And we used to get into these arguments about it. And you know, maybe he can argue, but every time we get into something, I tell him to do something and then he says it's the stupidest idea he's ever heard. And then 3 months later, he does it. So I told him, and I'll show you guys the deck. I made him a deck like maybe a year ago, being like, stop selling swords, sell candy boxes. You're never going to get rich selling swords. You know, I think they did $10 million or $12 million in top line revenue, maybe $1 million in EBITDA. And I'm like, that's awesome. You've maxed out. Your talent's being wasted in this niche. You need to get into a new niche.
Well said. Well said.
And yeah. So I'll send over the deck so you guys can check it out. Maybe put some screenshots. But I convinced him to do it. He almost bought out one of the big bento box candy suppliers. I think they ended up just merging, and that's what Kenpai Foods is, this new brand he launched. So I've been begging him to do it forever. And so I was the first check-in. It was small, 50 grand or whatever. I think he only wanted to raise like a couple hundred thousand. So that's why I invested, super excited. I'm going to try to get it in Best Buy because we got Best Buy relationships. I'm going to buy as much as I possibly can. So,
but yeah. It's incredible to see, because he took this new brand, apply the same playbook of like the social media flywheel of like making viral videos, and he's just off to the races already, which is really, really interesting. When you see like in the DTC space, we always talk about like creator-led brands, right? Like I feel like there's going to be more people like Isaac. Another thing I got from e-commerce fuel was Paul from BK Beauty. I think you all know BK Beauty. They sell like a brush, makeup brush, absolutely crushing it. And Paul did this presentation about how he scaled BK Beauty from literally zero to a million in sales per month on TikTok Shop. And the big takeaway from that presentation for me was like, not that TikTok Shop is crushing it and growing, whatever is going to happen to TikTok. I know that's another debate. But it was what happens when the founder is so focused on their craft, right? And I think like Isaac and Paul are both so focused. And that was pretty exciting, actually. That's another trend I've like kind of seen in the from Ecom Fuel. That was like one big takeaway when I was looking through it.
So Roman, I think one of the things that Isaac really illustrates, and we've seen this time and again, is that behind almost every really good e-commerce business, there is a founder that has some kind of a superpower. And it's actually interesting, like even on this, I think the superpowers of each of us is different. I think like there's areas of expertise that overlap, but there's definitely some differences in that Venn diagram. And, you know, Isaac's doing it a totally different way. Like I could never do it the way that Isaac is doing it. And Sean's doing it a different way than Isaac, and a different way than I'm doing it, or that Matt's doing it, or Jason and Hexcloud are doing it. And so I've seen that there's a lot of different paths to building something significant and something really profitable. But if you're not top 1, 2, 3% in something, it's going to be tough.
It's going to be
just
so
being
rough.
Pretty good in a bunch of areas, it's really difficult, because you have to have some kind of key strategic lever, like some kind of arbitrage, more or less, that you're going in and you're getting above market performance at below market rates. In Isaac's case, he knows how to really inexpensively get eyeballs, which is a great asset. And for some people, it's just like they're financial wizards. And so they're able to kind of orchestrate it on the balance sheet side of things and make it all work. But anyway, it's just worth calling out that if you're trying to build your business, you should be taking inventory of what are you elite at? What is your team elite at? Because you're going to need to be elite at something to make it work.
Yeah. And then focus on it. Like that was like the big punchline. I kind of forgot that lesson. But then I saw Paul and he just like obsessed about it, right? Like he did this one thing extremely well and did a 100-day sprint, and the results speak for themselves. So I think like the key thing is like when you find product channel fit, right? Like not like product market fit, but like your product is hitting it on one channel, just go all in. And like, again, don't diversify, right? Like that's what I see. Like if I were to talk about like the 100 plus founders that were struggling, they definitely fall into the bucket, Mike, of like trying to do many things to crawl their way out of their hole. And usually to crawl your way out of a hole, you have to do one thing and do it really well, you know, and go all in. Unfortunately.
Roman, I think it's a great point. I mean, we could talk about Isaac crushing it or Paul crushing it. The fact is they knew they had a problem and they tried a new solution to it, right? There's 100 plus founders who are like, yeah, Meta sucks now, but they don't have a next level, a next attempt. It's just like, I hope it gets better.
Yeah, exactly. 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 It's like, I'm going to react, you know, like 100%.
Yeah. So, you know, we can talk about the future of TikTok shops, or even if TikTok shops is viable for you or your brand. But the difference is Paul needed something to work, and he found traction on TikTok. And if you find traction, double down, right?
Like, yeah, exactly.
If you get one sale, you can get 10. If you get 10, you can get 100. If you get 100, you can get 1,000. We've all seen that play out.
And there's a difference between being elite strategically and being elite tactically. And I think one of the things that I see a lot in e-commerce is people who've learned how to be really, really effective, but at a very like tactical low level. And so it's like, hey, I know how to, you know, get the absolute most out of my Facebook campaigns. But then, you know, when Meta changes it, where they've intentionally structured it, where their, you know, machine learning and stuff makes any optimizations that you do ineffective, you don't have a higher strategic skill set to then recalibrate around how to create value. And so I think to kind of apply this, if you're listening to it, it's what is the higher strategic skill set that you have? And then once you find it, you relentlessly lean into it. And then when the environment changes, and it is going to change, we've seen, if there's anything we've seen over the last 4 years, it will change, and it will change a lot because we're in a digital competitive sphere. Then you actually have the tools and the muscles to be able to adapt and to build, you know, to build a successful income stream, even if the, you know, the sea changes.
Roman, if it's not Meta, so if all these people are struggling with Meta, where do you think, what's next, man? Like,
yeah,
so question. Much of this business runs on Meta.
Yeah, it's a really great question. I think like for all our businesses, we're not so dependent on Meta, surprisingly. It's pretty crazy. Like Raycon, obviously, I think it's not a hidden fact that we're big on YouTube influencers. With Nutrition Kitchen, you know, it's a subscription business, so we're quite insulated from like Meta's volatility, and 85% of the business is repeat subscription. For the other businesses, we have very strong cohort-based financing. So if you have Meta shitting on itself for a month, we're kind of okay. I don't know what's next, to be honest. I mean, for us, it's just, you know, beefing up our ability to re-engage with prospects. And the biggest thing for us this year, I wrote about it on Twitter, but you know, WhatsApp is going gangbusters for us because 50% of our revenue is non-US and people outside the US use WhatsApp. And that's just been an enormous, enormous channel for us year to date. And it's a gift that keeps on giving because it's A, not crowded. B, it's highly efficient. And I can see it getting more efficient because they're adding more features. We saw the roadmap for India. I think they're going to do that globally soon with payments and everything that comes with it. So I think it's just like, you know, Meta is just going to get more and more expensive. You just need to get better at getting more efficient at squeezing out the dollars, right? And you need to build a business that can withstand this volatility that, you know, Meta is bad for 2 weeks and you need to be able to take the pain, honestly.
Yeah.
That's the only answer.
I just want to say that what I think is happening is like waves of erasure. So like, Meta prices went up, $20 brands went away, then $40 brands, then $60 brands. And we're just in this new wave where, yeah, sub $100 brands, it doesn't work without subscription, without strong repeat. So it's, Meta is still going to be there, the biggest ad channel, but maybe it doesn't work for you. Your business doesn't fit the times. The best thing you can do is increase repeat rate, increase subscription take rate, increase AOVs. It's the price inflation.
Yeah, 100%.
And you've mentioned this, Sean, but Amazon has been hammering with new fees. I mean, they're raising the bar as well. This isn't just D2C. This is an entire ecosystem thing that's going on.
Hell yeah. Well, I want to get Jason in here. Jason, we got the Roman, the king of the guys. Any questions for him?
Like, I'm just fascinated by Hong Kong and Asia, and like Roman just seems to be living the life on a, and like, I mean, he's a killer operator and with a really nice business, but like it's not monstrously sized, right? You're not like
it's not
it's not crazy. So I don't know, like, how are you living the good life in Hong Kong, and how do I get on that train? That's what I want to
know. Well, Jason, I hate to burst your bubble. Roman is not an American citizen. So he's from the EU, from Norway. So he gets a little bit of a benefit. Do you want to explain that, Roman?
Yeah, exactly. So I don't pay tax, Norwegian taxes. I pay Hong Kong taxes. So my EBITDA is basically my net income. That's number one hack of living in Hong Kong. That's the number one hack. Number two and number three, it's just like tax jurisdictions.
As I'm about to blow my brains out looking at 2023 taxes and 2024 estimates that we need to do.
It's probably bigger than my EBITDA, but yeah.
Yeah, his California estimate is bigger than your EBITDA.
Yeah, for sure. For sure it is. Hopefully we can change that equation by acquiring more companies this year. But yeah, we don't pay taxes. That's number one. Number two is that living in Hong Kong we have an unfair advantage, right? So let's say I buy a company, I could never afford Hexclad, but I bought Hexclad. We have a 10-year-old trade entity in Hong Kong. So immediately, I mean, you know that, Jason, better than anyone, that negative working capital cash flow is a one-off impact, right? Like a one-off effect, right? So once I ingest the company, I can get inventory financing immediately at a cost that's so much lower than everyone else, right? So let's say I have a business that's just hoarding cash because they don't have payment terms with their factory, and it's just incinerating cash. They have EBITDA, but they're not cash flowing. I'm able to arb that because I'm in Hong Kong and get cheap Chinese financing. So those are the two main things. Like, that's the good about Hong Kong lifestyle is one is the taxes. Two is this ability to get very, 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 very cheap trade financing under the premise that your stuff is produced in China, obviously, right? So we're buying $30 million worth of goods in China, $10 million outside China, like India, some in the US even. But for the Chinese stuff, you can really get like this one-off incredible negative working capital effect, right?
After. Are you coming to LA on this trip?
I might. There's
will you come out and please spend some time with us?
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely. I need a skull sesh with Roman for an hour to talk about.
March 27th, Roman. March 27th.
Yeah, we have a big dinner, March 27th. Operators.
Okay, I'll come out. I'll see if my wife will allow me to stay out on the road for another week.
Let's go.
We'll see. But I would love to. I would love to come out.
Please do.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Before people get excited about this no tax thing, if you're an American citizen, we are the one country on earth where you are taxed on citizenship, not location. So if you want to live like Roman, you have to renounce your U.S. citizenship.
I'll adopt you and make you my child as long as you give me 51% of your company for $0, basically. No, all jokes aside. It's a great place. And I hope people visit me. I don't know if you guys saw, but we did this huge thing for the Canton Fair last year. We rented a yacht for like 90 people. It was an incredible boat. We did a bunch of hikes and a bunch of lunches. So I'm going to actually do that again this year, maybe in April, maybe next month. So if you happen to be in Hong Kong for the Canton Fair, just hit me up and then I'll make sure you get a seat. It's all free. We paid for everything. We have a BD budget at Peak 21.
Awesome.
So just come out. Awesome.
There was talk of a operator's private jet to Canton last year.
My EBITDA is smaller than Jason's tax bill, okay? Mike, don't go for a land grab, buddy.
Oh, listen, I'm always the guy. It's like, if you want to invite me on your private jet, I might say yes, but I'm not booking it.
Yeah, I went last year. I'm going to skip April this year, but I'll be back in China in August and September. And everyone listening should go to Hong Kong before the next 10 years. It's a beautiful, amazing city, and it is going to change a lot in the next 10 years. So go while you can. It's still one of the most unique places on earth.
It's incredible. I mean, it's 80% rainforest. If you come, hit me up. I love, you can work out of our office. We have a beautiful office with a harbor view in Shengwan. Just come up, come work out of our place. We'd love to have anyone who's
listening. Let's make some plans, dude.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me. Take care, guys.
All right. Bye.
That was an amazing episode. Thank you so much for having me, everyone at The Operators. We talked about how we at Peak 21 buy $30 million worth of goods from China with 90-day payment terms on average. We shoot the shit about Hong Kong, Sean moving to Hong Kong to evade taxes in the US, and in general, how we buy D2C companies. So if you're looking to sell your D2C company, hit us up. Our URL is peak21, peak21.io. Or you could just hit me up on Twitter, where my handle is a carbon copy of Sean, but it's Roman Ecom. And just hit me up, man. I'd love to speak to you.
Dude, Roman's copying everything. He took my handle. I've bought brands before. I was an investor in Isaac's thing first, but good friend, love to have him here. He's in the US for a couple more weeks, but if not, go to Hong Kong, visit him. And thank you for listening to the Operators Podcast. Thank you, Fulfill. Thank you, Northbeam. Thank you, Sendlane. Love you all. Roman, talk to you later in chat. Goodbye, everybody.